Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2013. Lecture 21, delivered on April 9, 2013. The title of this lecture is Bond Basics.
Today, Bond Basics. This is Chapter 14. I will cover in Chapter 14 bonds and preferred stock. I'm not going to go into leasing. It's a somewhat significant, but it's not much different from what I am going to cover. So today, bond basics. Now, I've gone through bonds before, the technical aspects of pricing bonds, and I've mentioned some of the actual details of bonds. Let me get down to some specifics about bonds. Isn't that great? Here, let me. There. Okay, now, a bond is, at its heart, a promise. It is a contract between a borrower, who is the seller of the bond, and a purchaser, the lender, the buyer of the bond. Now, when you buy bonds, if you were to start your own little portfolio for your retirement, which will happen someday, you would probably buy some stocks and buy some bonds. Almost without question, you would be buying in the secondary market. In other words, you would buy the bonds and the stock from someone else who owned them before you. You wouldn't be buying in the primary market where the issuer, you were dealing with the issuer. Oh, heh. Just testing that. Really? Is that fuzzy or am I just losing my... Hang on here. There. Secondary market. Now, okay. I'll get it together here. Okay. However, if you are involved, if you are investing through a mutual fund, it could be quite likely the case that the mutual fund, at least from time to time, would be buying its instruments in the primary market. In other words, it would buy right out of the box from a corporation that was issuing stock or bonds. So if you're in something like a mutual fund, you actually would, in a way, be participating in the primary market. But if you are buying as an individual, you are probably buying in the secondary market, whether it's stocks or bonds. So one way or the other, what I'm talking about here is the origin of the bonds. What is happening as it enters the primary market? The bond is actually a contract between a borrower and the lender. The lenders for corporate bonds are huge financial institutions, trusts, insurance companies, brokerages, what have you. And it's a contract. Now, the contract will have several, unquestionably, it'll have several important parts to it. These will be the covenants of the contract. And the covenants together, this thing, this contract, will be called the indenture agreement. It will serve as the model, as the guidelines about what will happen and what could happen under any circumstances during the life of the contract. One thing is for sure, obviously, is that the amount will be specified, the amount of the lending. And remember that we consider the lending in increments of $1,000 for the purposes of pricing. but you can have a borrowing of $1 billion. Also, the terms of repayment will be in there. Securitization. In other words, what is backing this instrument? Full faith and credit of the corporation, physical assets, accounts receivable. What is backing it? If nothing is backing it, it's called a debenture. Now, if it is a, it can be unsecured. In other words, it's just backed by the company's cash flows, debenture, or it can be some type of a mortgage bond. Now, typically, remember what I told you about mortgages. When we borrow money for a house, there's a difference between the note, the indenture agreement, the promissory note, which is the actual lending, and the agreement about what is backing it, which would be the house. That's called the mortgage agreement, which is separate from the promissory note itself. The promissory instrument itself. So now, in terms of the mortgage, is this a first mortgage, a second mortgage? In other words, is there a prior claim on this asset in an earlier bond? Is also what exactly? What? What order? Where do you stand in the pecking order? Are you the primary, secondary? Okay. Sometimes you'll even see things like how long this asset is securing this. So if the bond has gone, is a 20-year bond, and maybe after 12 years it might release from the mortgage on it. That's rare, but it happens, okay? And in the what, let me write here. It could be a physical asset, or it could be a financial. Like I said, it could be a building or a or trucks or something like that, or it could be the accounts receivable, something like that. So you can have different kinds of animals in here that are backing it. There will be other things too. Like, for example, you can have convert. Here's one. The callability of the bond. A callable bond is a bond that the borrower can pay off early. A callable bond is a bond that the borrower can bring back early. So, example, if a company has a bond issued and it's making 8% coupon payments, but interest rates have fallen so that it could pay off, it could reissue at, let's say, 5%, then after a certain number of years, this company can borrow again and pay off the 8% lenders, leaving them out in the cold, and reissue at 5%. If it does that, obviously the people who lend the money are going to not be as happy, so they're going to punish the bond a little bit on that. Another one is convertibility. Convertibility. Some bonds, if the company really gets into trouble, it can just turn the bond into stock. So you're a lender, you have the prior claim, and you're about to nail that company because it's not going to be able to pay off its debts. Well, the company could turn it into stock. So suddenly you're a shareholder in a dying corporation. Convertibility is not cool at all. It's risky to get involved with convertible bonds. Okay. There are other things that can happen. You can see in bonds, there are all kinds of different provisions. Okay. Now, in terms of the repayment, the typical way, and you already know this, the typical way a bond works is that over the life of the bond, all the corporation is paying the lenders is the interest. Periodic interest represented by the coupon. So if this is, let's say, just pull one out of the hat. MFST, 6.5%, 2019 issue, then every year, someone who holds a $1,000 bond will get a $65 check every year. Now, as you remember, it actually can happen two times a year, $3,250 a year. $3,250? Yeah. Or it could even happen every quarter. So it would be $1,625 every quarter. But over the life of the bond, that's what's being paid. So in other words, you're servicing the debt as the borrower, you're servicing the debt, and then at the end, you pay off, you pay one last $65 coupon payment, and then you pay the $1,000 principal, the face value of the bond. That's the typical way they work. However, lenders aren't stupid because, I mean, all of a sudden, there in 2019, This borrower, Microsoft in this case, has to pay off $1 billion in bonds just out of nowhere. The lenders are going to say, we want a sinking fund or something like it. And we will have in the indenture agreement a sinking fund provision. In other words, by the rules of the contract, the company, the borrower, will have to put a certain amount of money in a pool, a reserve that it cannot touch, so that at 2019, it has the money to pay off the face value. You'll see it in the accounting statements. Oftentimes, it shows up in the balance sheet, but you'll see more extensive explanation of it in the notes to the financial statement, what these sinking funds are. They can actually kind of surprise you because the company will have, you'll see, oh, I paid this much interest here, and okay, all that good stuff. And then you'll look and, oh, there's this big pile of money that's being plopped into this sinking fund every year that you really don't see on the financial statements that clearly, certainly not in the income statement, but this is real cash flow coming out of this corporation's pocket into an untouchable fund so that it'll have enough money to pay off the face value of the bonds it has due. So always keep an eye out on those financial statements for these sinking funds because they can take a pretty decent little whack out of the cash flow of a company just because the lenders say, you better have all the money we are owed at the end of this agreement. Now, sinking funds have all kinds of different behaviors. It used to be, before I actually learned in the real world about finance, I thought, well, you know, it's like they owe $1 million and they owe that in 20 years, so you just divide $20 by $1 million, that's how much will go in the sinking fund every year. No, they work all kinds of different ways. Some of them are loaded forward so that more of the money is being put in the early years than in the back years. I saw one, and I didn't understand it until it was explained to me. Essentially, the fund, the sinking fund provision, had not very much money at all going into the sinking fund the first 5 years. And then all of a sudden, it ramped up. Lots of money was going in. And then in the ending years, not much money at all. And then it was explained to me by an old analyst. He said, you see, this is a company that's going, the lenders, no, this company's going to be struggling the first few years. So the lenders are going to say, look, you got a few years of breathing room because we want you to make sure you have the cash flow to actually survive. But 5 years from now, you got to get started and you got to get this sinking fund built up for us so that by the time we get to like year 15, you've got most of the money ready to pay us off in 20 years. And 5 years later. So you'll see these sinking fund provisions designed all kinds of ways. Just look for them in your financial statements. Whether you're a financial analyst or you're just someone who's looking at companies in general, even if you're someone who's looking for employment in a company. Here's an interesting thing that I've found out over the years. I don't know if it's something that'll be important to you, but it's really nice to be paid, your paycheck. I mean, I get excited about being paid. So as such, now you're old enough, don't you like to have your paycheck? So it might not hurt you to look at the financial situation of a company that you are going to be where you're going to be employed, to see, are they really a strong company, robust, financially sound? Because at the end of the day, you are going to want to make sure that you are going to be paid and also that they are financially sound enough that you're not going to suddenly be surprised in a few years by getting laid off with that company. So it doesn't hurt to look at the financial statements in general and also to keep your eye on the free cash flow. And one of the ways you do that is look at these things like how much of that net income is actually going to disappear before, or how much of the operating income or how much of the gross income is going to actually be there to pay people like me. Because you are actually debt holders on a corporation. By working for them, they have an obligation to pay you before they pay their shareholders. But on that multi-story outhouse that is corporate life, you are on the first floor of the multi-story shit house as far as debt holders are concerned. In other words, everyone gets a crap down and you'll land your last on the list. So you want to make sure that everyone above you is being taken care of before, because you will be the last one who's taken care of probably before things get bad. Now, let me do a couple of other things here real quick. Okay, different kinds of bonds. Now, I'm going to divide bonds up in all kinds of ways for you here. There's corporate bonds and there's government bonds. There's also this other kind of bond that's called a personal bond. That's your kind of borrowing, which could be a promise, which could be a bill, a note, or a bond. I'm using that term rather loosely here, bond. The two that we're focusing on here today are the corporate and the government. One thing that they have in common is that they are all coupon-bearing instruments. In other words, they pay interest, they service the debt, and then at the end of the life of the instrument, they pay off the principal. The one that is a little bit distinct are the discount bonds that the government has, those T-bills. You just buy it for like $970, and then in a year, the government pays you $1,000. So basically, your interest, your coupon, is that spread on that difference between the price you bought it at and the sale and the face value. But other than that, the one thing that definitely binds these is that these are both coupon-bearing instruments, almost always. There are a few corporate bonds I'll bring up here in a little while that aren't interest-bearing. We'll talk about this in a minute. Now, government bonds are essentially unsecured in the sense that their security is the full faith and credit of the United States government. That means that if the government were to default, you couldn't claim some physical asset. Whereas in corporate bonds, some are like that. There's no actual physical or financial thing to claim, but others can be mortgage bonds. But the government bonds are all, none of them are mortgage bonds. Now, let me do one real quick thing here that kind of has slid over a little bit in the book, but it's a timely subject right now. When we talk about the deficit, essentially, the difference between tax revenues and what the government is spending. That is financed, that spread, that gap, that hole, is spread through the issuing of treasury instruments, treasury bills, notes, and bonds. So, in other words, the federal debt is the accumulation outstanding of those borrowings from period to period that the government has to do through its treasury in order to pay bills. Our government debt right now stands at approximately, I believe it's $16 trillion. That is the accumulation of the debt outstanding from all the borrowings in the past, including borrowings that we had to refinance in order to pay off a debt that was maturing. So we have the treasury debt. Right here, treasury. There's another kind of debt, however, that is off the books, that isn't part of official national debt. This is called agency debt. Now, the Treasury debt has the full, has the backing of the full faith and credit of the United States government. Agency debt doesn't. Now, agency debt is issued by, surprisingly, agencies of the United States government to finance their specific operations, which are not exactly for all the people. So, example, agency debt would include the debt from these quasi-government agencies like the Ginny Mae and the Fannie Mae, those massive secondary mortgage market companies, which are sort of like semi-government. There's Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, Sally Mae. That's the student loan thing. These massive pools where these agencies borrow their own money to do their operations and to have the money to do what they do. Other ones in this would be things like the Tennessee Valley Authority to fund its water management water and sewage management operations in the Tennessee Valley. And there are others of these all over the country. These organizations borrow money to fund their operations, and then through their operations, they generate revenue to pay off their debt. Now, agency debt, again, is not counted in the national debt. Over a period of years, starting in the late 1970s, actually the early 1980s, agency debt went from this tiny, tiny little thing to this big, large. I mean, it was noticeable in terms of the national debt. Not, you know, it wasn't like 50%, but it was a significant portion. I believe that at its peak, it hit something like almost 20% of as large as the entire national debt that was debt outstanding from these agencies. Interestingly enough, since 2009, that agency debt outstanding has contracted a lot for several reasons. So it's not the big concern. You know, when we talk about the national debt, that's scary enough. And then people would say, well, you're not looking at the treasury, the agency debt. That makes it even worse. And yeah, it did, but it has actually declined over the past 4 or 5 years. It's gotten a lot. It's gotten noticeably smaller. The thing about agency debt is it is not backed by the full faith and credit of the United States government. However, investors assume that if one of these agencies got into trouble and it started to default on its debt, the government would step in and take care of it. And in fact, it did. With these secondary mortgage market beasts that just completely screwed the pooch, the government did indeed step in and save the day. So even though they're not backed by the full faith and credit of the United States government, by the indenture agreement, the investors knew that the government was not going to let these things just go off, fall off the face of the earth. Okay? Now, I'm going to go down here, and I'm going to do a little bit more with the government debt. There is the federal government, the Treasury, as I said, and agencies issue bonds, notes, bills. They do it. To fund operations that cannot be paid for through revenues, tax revenues. But then other sovereigns within the framework of the Constitution can also issue and do also issue debt. There is state debt. States can borrow to fund operations. Here is an interesting thing. Some states have laws that prohibit their state from borrowing money. But they do anyway. It's sort of like, I have made a rule that I shall have no whiskey in my house. It's out in the backyard. And so then we come down to all of these different jurisdictions and taxing authorities that can jump into the game. You have municipalities, We call the debt that they issue munis. Now, under interpretation of the Constitution, if you invest in municipal securities, the interest you get on that on those investments is not taxed at the federal level. So it's tax exempt. But all that means is that it's for rich people to use those, because remember, with high tax rates, the tax shield from a tax exempt muni is great. For a lowly slob, I mean, you know, with a 15% tax bracket, there's no reason to, because the interest rates on these munis are small, reflecting the tax exempt status. So if the rate on a muni should be 6%, those munis will actually be issued at, let's say, 4%, 4.5%, because the wealthy investors get that much of a shield on the tax-exempt status. So they're really only for wealthy investors, these munis are. That focus sucks on that there. Yeah, okay. Let me pull that up just a little bit so you can see a little more. I'm gonna kill that stupid thing here. Okay, yeah. Now, municipals. They are not generally backed by like an asset. Oftentimes what you'll see in terms of munis is what's called a revenue bond. Okay, we are going to issue this bond, and so you investors who lend us the money, what we're going to do is we're going to create a tax to pay the coupons and pay the principal back to you. So for 20 years, we're going to up the taxes on people who live in our city for the purpose of paying on this bond and paying it off. So this gives the investors great assurance. The problem is that it's not perfect assurance, because some kinds of these revenue bonds, if times get bad and people aren't buying, then tax revenues go down. It makes it harder for the munis, for the authorities to pay the interest payments on the munis. So usually you'll see other things. Well, if you can't cover it with the tax base on the, from this bump tax, then you're going to have to show us that there's another way that you're going to cover us. So the munis are like that. Now, there are other ones too. Within the municipals, there are different kinds. Some are for things like having water, a better water supply, sewage system. Or you can have these ones for things like in Bloomington, Illinois, they had to borrow money to build that incredible, awesome Coliseum of theirs, which was the biggest fiasco on earth from the beginning. But they wanted it, so they borrowed the money to do it, and they issued bonds to do it. The town of Normal has this convention center that they want to, it's the dream, it will bring everyone in the world to the hot, hot town of Normal, where we will all party like it's 1999, or not. But there you are. It's going to be there. And in order to fund these, you can have all kinds of different tricks. One is bump the sales tax. So, for example, because my business is located here, its physical presence is here, I not only have to pay the state tax, but I also have to pay a 0.5% local tax too. And that is entirely to fund these incredibly stupid these really great projects that are being brought forward. Then you have school districts have their own work to do. They have to build schools larger and larger, pack the kids in like sardines, provide them with an education to prepare them for the 18th century. Right here. So to borrow that money, they have to go to heavy-duty, powerful lenders. We had a speaker just a couple of weeks ago for my finance students in the Illinois State Students in Finance. He was an underwriter who actually was the one who set up the financing, the buyers for school district bonds. Part of his job is to go to school board meetings and listen to Ma and Pa Kettle bitch about, well, I don't think we need a new school. I don't want to pay more in property taxes and all that. He has to deal with that. He has to deal with those kinds of school bonds, municipal bonds, and all of that. Top that off with what could also be, interestingly enough, right in this area, there is a special provision. When there's a community college here in town called Heartland Community College, which I fondly call Heartburn Community College. Now, Heartburn has the authority by its charter to issue debt without a vote, a levy, to build buildings, to make Heartland a bigger school. They use that authority to simply build more buildings, borrowing the money and putting an additional surcharge on the property taxes paid by the people in the 6-county area served by Heartburn. So you can have a community college or other local institution that might be able to borrow and then tax or whatever to pay its borrowings. And these are all out there, all swirling around, competing for money. And each of them in its own way having some way to do it. Now, these are in general, first of all, I should point out here, school districts almost always have to have a vote of the property, have a vote of the owner, of the people in the community, in order to approve a bond issue to build buildings or something like that. That has proven to be a very difficult proposition, because most of the time when people see, oh, we're going to be taxed, they'll say no. And so you will have the schools get worse and worse. This was a spiraling problem through the 80s and 90s and the early 2000s with school districts that were just going to hell. Their textbooks were 20 years out of date. Their buildings were literally not safe to be in. But the voters, hell, I don't want no more taxes. We ought to cut the pay of them teachers. And obviously it's their logical incentive not to be taxed. So that has gone through court challenges, and some states are just simply going to the point where they're saying, look, you know what? We can't rely on voters to do what's in the best interest of their kids. So more and more you're seeing funding tilting toward just the state taking over and dealing with the problem. Unfortunately, it's not a federal issue because the U.S. Constitution is silent on education. Silent. So this all has to happen in state legislatures and in state court systems where they determine fairness of taxation, fairness of educational opportunities, and all of that. Okay. Back to the main point, though. This is just the public sector I'm showing you here. A very large federal government that requires an extraordinary amount of money to operate. Just in terms of our military, just for the functionality, we have generally, our doctrine has been for more than, well, first we had to deal with creating a deterrent effect against the Soviet Union and China to some extent. But anymore, we have what is essentially a permanent war, the GWAT, the Global War on Terror. Plus, we had a little spat in Iraq, based on false information about weapons of mass destruction, a mess of a war in Afghanistan. So right there, the military is committed to a huge amount of money. As we are winding those wars down, oh, thank God, we got $4 trillion on the hook from those two messes. We are seeing ourselves getting ready to engage in North Africa, which is getting hot. We have a little problem with North Korea, which shouldn't take more than just a few small megatonnage weapons to make it a nice parking lot. And then, what is it with that guy? Oh, we're going to bomb everything. Like, really? Bring it. Come on. But anyway, and then we got Iran, which will be a war eventually. So the commitment has been for a number of years now that we must be battle ready for two theater wars. That's expensive in terms of military personnel, which is really tiny, but in terms of the war material required to be battle ready, that's expensive. Plus, you have a group of programs that we cannot make go away. They're called entitlements, which is an unfortunate name. But we can't just say, well, we're not going to fund those anymore. Yes, we are. And you would not really not like it if those entitlement programs went away, because some of those would make your life miserable if they weren't there. So we have all those. Then we have discretionary spending. So we have this large amount of money needed by the Treasury, which we cannot finance through taxes because we cut taxes so low and for so long in 2002 that we can't recover. We just can't. So we're going to borrow money. We are just going to. And then you have the agencies. Fortunately, they're backing down on their debt needs. But this complex of states, I mean, we got 50 of these. We probably have another one within about 4 or 5 years. We'll have another state. And then we got just literally hundreds and hundreds of thousands of municipalities that have to borrow money. Then we have literally hundreds and hundreds of thousands of school districts across the country that have to borrow money because capital expenditures have to be made. And then we got all these other local institutions that borrow money. So what is essentially going on in this list that I have given you here is an extraordinary drain on available global capital, an extraordinary drain on available local global capital. These sovereign entities have to do what they have to do to survive. And believe me, we've had defaults of municipals. Munis have defaulted. In a few cases, other things have defaulted too. But let me tell you, when one municipal defaults, it is earth-shattering. Does anyone know an example of a city that defaulted on a municipal bond? Were any of you ever taught? Cleveland did. Cleveland defaulted. It was like the end of the world. A city defaulted on a muni? Those things were supposed to be perfectly safe. Well, it was Cleveland, for God's sake. You know? So you got that, this mass of all these different demanders in the global capital markets. Investors pay attention to these because in general, these are very safe instruments. In general, rich people like them because they're tax exempt at the federal tax exempt. So these compete for global capital against the corporate borrowers on this side of the equation. These, they're just right up against each other. Private investment versus public investment. And then you've got people who want money. Borrow homes. Someday you're going to want your own home. You're going to have 2.5 kids, one dog, 2 cats, a wife, and a mistress. You've got a lot of money to pay. Dude, you're going to have to borrow, okay? The good news is that you'll work so hard you'll die of a heart attack at 45. The bad news is that her boy toy is going to move in the day after they bring your corpse out, smiling. So you have the personal side of it, this massive amount of borrowing. Now, I'm going to assign you a series of articles that I wrote in 2007, 2008. I was building up trying to explain and teach the principles in financial economics behind why there was going to be a crisis, a really bad financial meltdown. Of course, we know that never happened, but I wrote about it anyway. And you'll understand how we financed this, what trick we did to be able to live beyond our means, both as people, as corporations, and as a government structure. We did it, And it cost us dearly, and it will cost you throughout your productive lives. Because first of all, we were diminished by this trick that we were doing. Through the 2000s, we were just being, it was just ruining us in a way. And we're not done yet because we didn't learn the first time. We're doing exactly what we did the last time. And I'll get to that right now with the corporate bonds. And I think I already talked about this a little bit. The stock markets, the United States, U.S. stock markets have been going up dramatically, smartly over the past few months. Corporate profits are at an all-time high. The stock markets have recovered from the massive losses in the financial meltdown. It is one of the, it's a dramatic turnaround. As several others have pointed out, the conservatives call Obama a socialist. Having corporate profits at their highest and having taxes at their historical lowest, and also having the Dow Jones and the Standard & Poor's at the highest they've ever been, he sucks as a socialist. But there you go. Great story. Stock market's rising. That means that there must be a huge amount of buying going on in the stock markets right now. That's how stock prices go up. Demand goes up, prices go up. Demand for stocks go up, stock prices go up. What's driving that? You ask the average investor, you buying stocks? No. Well, okay, typical trust fund, you buying stocks? Well, not really too much. I'm a little defensive. So what's propelling it? It's the corporations who issued the stock who are buying it back. They are borrowing massive hundreds of billions of dollars, combining that with their free cash flow reserves, which are really good, and they're going into the markets and they're buying their own stock back and putting it in the treasury. So they're borrowing. They're leveraging themselves into a capital structure that is far more. Whereas you would have had percent debt before the surge, the percent debt and the percent equity, the percent debt average of the Standard & Poor's 500 would have been down here, and the equity would have been the complement of that to 100%. Now you see these companies pulling their debt towards 100%. They won't get to 100%, but they're leveraging themselves hugely toward debt. They're borrowing money. As a result of that, the corporate bond market is just going crazy. Lots and lots of corporate bonds being issued. Using the word billions doesn't cover it. And then, interestingly, these corporate bonds are now being used as new fuel to back credit derivative swaps. The same things that caused the financial crisis to turn into a zombie apocalypse nearly in 2008, it's happening again because all of this debt is now being used, all of this new corporate debt is being used. The banks got the federal regulators to take the reins off them in terms of how much inventory of CDOs they could have. So now the banks are back in the business of inventorying these swaps. And every time a new corporate bond is issued, they have a swap that they can use that bond to back and then throw those swaps out there. Then swaps are written on the swaps. Swaps are written on the swaps of the swaps. And before you know it, we're back in the business we were that caused the last crisis to turn into a nightmare. So there you are. We got a problem, but it's your problem, not mine. Corporate bonds. Let's go through just a few varieties on corporate bonds. Now, as I said, companies can issue very short-term bills like commercial paper. They can also issue notes that are short-term instruments. And then they can issue the bonds, which are usually typically anywhere from 10 to 30 years. Also, once in a while, you'll see a super long bond. The super longs are 50, 100, 200 years in duration. They're out there. Governments are issuing them too. So you've got the maturity. The maturity is one way you can divide up the corporate debt world. Another way that, and I also mentioned callability, convertibility. Another way that you can break up bonds. Oh, I should mention something here. And I know I said something about this earlier in the course, and I want to emphasize it, just bring it up. These got popular back in the 1990s. They're a kind of bond called a ZCB. Zero coupon bonds. These bonds sell, are like 7 years, 10 years long, but they don't pay a coupon. The company just pays off the face value of the bond like 7 years out. So the way the bond works, though, is that I, as an investor, will lend the company, let's say, $400. In 7 years, I'll get $1,000 back. Okay? That's called a zero coupon bond, a ZCB. They are highly risky. They are issued because a company has no cash flow or so little that there's no way it can pay a coupon. But if the company believes and the investors accept the possibility that the company will be on its feet in 7 years and able to pay off. So very quickly, just to give you one of these, a ZCB, if I issue a 7-year ZCB at a price of, let's say, $400. At a price of $400. What that means is that in 7 years, I'm going to get $1,000 back for a $400 investment today. You follow the idea of it? So now, how do you figure out what the annual yield is on one of these suckers? What I'm going to do is I'm going to put $1,000 divided by 400, and I'm going to raise it to the 1/7 power, subtract 1, and then times the result by 100%. If you ask me why I'm doing that, I will give you a wedgie, okay? No, seriously. Life is short. $1,000 is a face divided by 400. Now I'm going to raise that to the 1/7 power. I'm going to subtract 1, and then I'm going to times the result by 100. And I'll find out that the annual yield is 13.99%. Face over price, raise it to the 1 over the number of years, then subtract 1 and times by 100. Again, face over price to the reciprocal of the number of years, minus 1 times 100. Don't forget to minus 1, noobs. I've forgotten to myself, and I've gotten these really surprisingly great interest rates. Okay, you follow it? Face over price to the reciprocal of the number of years, minus 1, times 100%. ZCBs were of a class of bonds that are called junk bonds. Junk bonds are bonds that are not of investment grade. In other words, they are risky. Now, when I say risky, have you ever seen those YouTubes of the people who eat those peppers that are insanely hot? You know, we're talking risky on that kind of a level, where there's possibility of death or disembowelment, something like that. Junk bonds, these qualify in the class of junk bonds. They were an innovative instrument. See, back in the 1990s, everything was going up. Business was booming. Unemployment was lower than it had ever been before on a sustained basis, but there was no inflation. It just pissed off the Federal Reserve chairman of that time, Alan Greenspan. He couldn't believe this was happening. He kept trying to kill it, saying, well, this is inflation. There wasn't. It was just everything was booming, including this whole internet revolution. They called part of it, the dot-com boom, because these small companies with all kinds of ideas about the internet, which was actually very much different back then than it is now, even just that few, these few years later. And so they needed a way to finance these small companies. And there were these players like Michael Milken and others who were inventing ways to finance them. And of course, when the dot-com boom went crash, because the Federal Reserve under Greenspan just couldn't stand it, they just kept raising interest rates up, 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 trying to stop the growth of the economy. Well, the interest rate sensitive companies that had very little cash flow but a lot of debt, they just crashed. And that was called the dot-com bust because so many of those companies died. And then, of course, the evil people were the players who had set up the instruments, the Michael Milkins and people like that. And because essentially these ZCBs and all these other junk instruments just went crash like a boss. And so, you know, it was just the end of the game. When you have the price on an instrument like this, $400, fluctuate just a little bit, the volatility on the yield is just amazing. So they were highly risky instruments. And so when interest rates, the discount rate, the Fed just kept pushing it up, pushing it up, pushing it up. Finally, it was just like snap. A lot of these instruments that were highly interest rate sensitive, just they were gone. You know, it was game over. I quit. I'm going home. Shoot myself with my Glock. Okay, so here's another way that you divide up securities. And I'll do this on Thursday. I'm going to actually show you how to determine investment grade bonds versus, shall we say, non-investment grade. And I want you to put down non-investment grade, but also put down junk. Now, the term junk, have you ever heard the old saying, one man's junk is another man's treasure? It's true. I mean, I eat White Castles. Do you eat White Castle? Do you know what a White Castle is? Okay, do you eat them? They're junk to you. For me, they're dinner. You know what's more? They're dinner with a date. In other words, it doesn't mean don't ever buy this. But all you have to know what it is. Junk is actually something that some investors prefer. They choose to take the risk. They choose to roll the dice, play the lottery, eat the ghost pepper, or the newest one, the scorpion pepper. They choose to do this. So there is a market for the junk. Some of this junk is just simply bonds that have gone bankrupt. Companies that are near bankruptcy, they're near death, and so their bonds sell at like insane discounts to par. Others are just, the companies are highly risky. So when you have that kind of risk, surprise, surprise, the returns that you expect on it are very high. And as I said, there are three primary rating agencies that do bonds and other instruments too. The rating agencies, and each of them has its own letter designations for investment grade, investment quality, I should say, are Standard & Poor's, Moody's, and Fitch. And I've said some of these things through the course. This is where I consolidated. Don't take these three rating services as guarantees of investment quality. All three of these agencies have screwed the pooch. All three of these agencies are driven by profit agendas, political agendas, and personalities of the people within the organization. Standard & Poor's was a fiasco of, this is an investment-grade bond before 2008. Ditto for Moody's, ditto for Fitch. Standard & Poor's last year downgraded the investment quality of U.S. government bonds, treasury bonds. The question is, really? You don't even understand. You see, with a sovereign bond, it will pay. No, there's not an investment grade to it. Don't say there's a possibility of default, because if it ever did default, that's the end of it anyway. Standard & Poor's will be torn down by the mobs just like everything else will be. So this idea Standard & Poor's had, it was just being political, showing that it was going to be defiant of the government's fines that were levied on S&P for screwing up investment recommendations before the crisis in 2008. Standard & Poor's goes back and says, we're going to downgrade government bonds. Last month, the U.S. Department of Justice issued an indictment of Standard & Poor's. Essentially, the issue there was in the indictment. It wasn't written, but the question really was, who's your daddy? Okay, you have enough financial training from me, the greatest teacher that God ever put on the planet in finance. You can look at financials for yourself. These are just guidelines. Hoover's is a guideline. There are all these places that are guidelines. At the end of the day, look to yourself and say, does it smell good or does it smell like White Castles? If it smells like White Castles, I'm there. If you want to be with me, great. That's all I have for you. I thank you.